Hi, this is John Udell. My guest for today's podcast is Mary Sherwinski, who works in Microsoft Research on adaptive user interfaces that leverage our spatial and temporal memories. I'd seen Mary's name in an article at seattlepi.com, and I'd written a blog entry about the process of finding where it was that I'd seen that article. So that's the bit that you'll hear her refer to in the beginning.
Hi, John. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
I liked your little search story. That was a riot.
Does that ring a bell for you, too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, we talk about this all the time. In my group, we do a lot of work on task management, activity management, and information processing. And cutting across all your devices is a huge problem. And now with all your sharing folders and websites and, you know, you name it, your stuff is everywhere. And getting access to stuff you've touched before is a huge visualization and interaction problem that we try to solve.
Yeah. So I was looking through your list of publications, and there were a couple of things there that I wanted to ask you about.
Oh.
There seems to be kind of a theme here in your work, leveraging our experience of the physical world, our spatial awareness, our awareness of time as ways to help organize our experience of the digital world.
Right.
One of the examples that I saw, which I thought was very interesting, was this notion of code snippets. And so, not snippets, but thumbnails. That's it.
Uh-huh. Code thumbnails.
Yeah. And so it looked like you had done a prototype for Visual Studio where what would happen was the entire corpus of source code would be thumbnailed so that you could sort of scan it that way. How did that work out?
That tested out pretty well. You definitely have to have the available screen real estate. So you have to have, you know, dual or triple monitors layout in order to take advantage of that, because otherwise you wouldn't keep it up all the time, in which case you probably wouldn't memorize the spatial locations of things, you know, and you wouldn't kind of just go click on it, which was the most valuable thing, was when it was up all the time and you could just click on it or search in it.
Yeah.
But if you have the available screen real estate, I had people tell me that they would actually jettison using Eclipse and switch to Visual Studio just to have that application, because it was so easy to find their files and to do searches on related things and to see everything all at once was just incredible.
See everything all at once is a profound imperative.
That's huge.
If you talk to people who are proponents of dynamic languages, and in fact, I'm one of them.
Uh-huh.
One of the key things is that you can do more with the amount of code that fits on one page. I think it would be interesting to people for you to talk a little bit about what the process is for, on the one hand, doing a prototype like you did, and then how things like that do or don't sort of move into the world of delivered products.
That's interesting. I'm actually delivering a talk on a panel at CHI, our biggest conference, in 2 months on this exact topic. I don't think about it very much because it's kind of what we do for a living. So, you know, it's kind of like how you're introspecting on your search behaviors. I have to introspect on how I live my life. But so I work with some very talented computer scientists. I'm a cognitive psychologist. So I don't usually, I can code, but I don't usually build the prototypes myself. Mm-hmm. They usually build them.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I'm working with some folks over in a kind of software development group in research. They're very, very interested in helping developers at Microsoft and also all around the world become more efficient. So in this case, Rob DeLine built the prototype based on some earlier research that George Robertson and I did on something called Data Mountain, which was a real visual way of seeing all your favorite files at once in one view in a 2.5D kind of mountain view, and leveraging spatial memory. So you could put things higher or lower on the mountain, to the right or to the left, and it was sonified.
You have to unpack that term a little bit.
Oh, sorry. Sonified means it had spatial audio cues.
Mm-hmm.
There was higher and lower pitch as you moved up or down the mountain, and it used the left and right speakers more or less as you moved in that dimension.
And the things were organized as favorites based.
So if the user thought it was a crappy website or not something that they would go back to very often, they tended to put it further back on the mountain, you know, more towards the top, further away from them.
Yeah.
Because it got smaller, and so you couldn't see it as much, and stuff they needed all the time would be real close and big.
Just like the messy piles on your desk.
Exactly. We do a lot of that, try to replicate the real world, like you were saying.
Yeah.
And so when Rob saw that, he's like, oh, you could do that with code. You know, you could do that with files of code. So he tried to emulate that, but we didn't use 2.5D. We just used 2D. And in fact, we would pick a layout for the user, for the developer, to start out with. And it could be based on many, many things. It could be based on how frequently you access things. It could be based on the semantic relatedness of files and so on. Rob just picked a default based on what he knew about this particular code base we were using.
Mm-hmm.
Then we let the developers rearrange it however they wanted. That's typically what we do. We have the developer or the principal scientist that's a good computer scientist prototype something up in an environment that's easy to quickly build something. So it could be something like an InfoViz toolkit or an information visualization toolkit like Piccolo.net, which is what I think he used in this case, or we have our own information visualization toolkits or platforms that we use. Sometimes our designer even just does things in Flash, you know, if it just needs to be interactive enough, you know, not hooked to a database or something, you can even just use something like Flash.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do that to the point that it's good enough that a real information worker or developer or whoever our target end user is could actually come in and do some real work. And we also usually take it to the step where we're logging the user's interactions quite a bit.
Right.
So even though I'm in the room, especially with the developers, because I love sitting with developers, it's so much fun, they're so smart. Even though I'm sitting there logging their behaviors, I like to know that there's something objective back there, tracking every keystroke, tracking every movement, because no matter what, I'm going to miss something, you know.
Right.
So these guys are really good at logging and timestamping things in the logs. So we can go back and we can do any kind of query we want, like how often did they access that file, or how often did they actually use the code thumbnail window to access a file versus using find, you know. And we can run those kinds of queries and get some real interesting statistics. And that's how I know that the code thumbnails was actually useful, because we went in and we looked at how often they actually used that view as opposed to the things that they were really used to using in Visual Studio.
What's the status of that project today, then, and what is the likelihood that it will become a feature in the shipping product?
That's the other side of our work. So we have to pound the pavement, go knock on the doors of the right people, twist their arms to listen to us talk about this stuff, show them the numbers. I mean, you always have to do the user studies, because at Microsoft, the product teams are really, they're very good about doing usability studies. They're very good about knowing their customers. So if you can't show them that what you've got is better than their existing shipping tools,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're mincemeat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we have to do. And luckily, in Microsoft Research, we have these people called program managers for research,
mm-hmm.
and they actually help us make those connections. So they'll actually arrange the meeting with the right Visual Studio people, because that's their job, to know who they are and who we should be talking to. And we actually are getting ready to have that meeting right now about code thumbnails. We haven't had it yet.
Okay.
Where we go and then we present the data, and hopefully then they'll say, yeah, let's ship it.
So this question about better is a kind of a subtle one, though, because
yes,
it's really better for whom. And as you know, human beings have very different cognitive styles. And in fact, one of the perceptions that people have, certainly I have in the past had, is that there's sort of a pretty narrow bottleneck that things have to pass through.
Yeah.
Either it becomes a feature of Windows or Office, or it doesn't. And if it does, it's because it's judged to have sort of mainstream, massive appeal, right? It will work for most people. But if, in the end, most people really sort of dissolves into all of these different constituencies, could there or shouldn't there be a way to deliver into those more narrow constituencies?
Yeah.
This thumbnail feature might work incredibly well for, let's say, 12% of the people who use Visual Studio, and the rest would just never care about it. How do you connect to that 12%?
Well, that's a long-term research agenda that you're just laying out, studying things longitudinally in the field, trying to get as many target end users as you possibly can to look at this, with as many different styles of programming as you can to look at this. We use converging lines of evidence here in research. The product team needs to make sure that they kind of throw their net out a little more broadly than we have to in research. In research, what we found is that, for instance, this way of leveraging spatial memory in your visualization of stuff,
mm-hmm.
we found that benefits everybody. So males benefit a little bit from it. They're very highly spatial. So I always say you can give a man a pinhole and they can look at their stuff and orient just fine. But females, for some reason, really, really benefit from it, especially if you can give them even more cues from the real world, like a large display, some optical flow cues, especially in 3D environments. For some reason, females really benefit from that. So it's one of those cool things that everybody benefits from it, but some people, like 50% of the population, benefit from it way more than others.
Mm-hmm.
So what we found is, unlike what you said, leveraging spatial memory comes for free and it helps everybody.
Okay.
So that's cool.
Okay.
we want to build more of that kind of stuff. There's a reason why you have piles all around your desk. It's because you'll remember where that stuff is. You might not remember how deeply within that pile you put it, but you'll probably remember the pile that you put it in.
Right.
So the more you can emulate that kind of transfer into your virtual world, the more benefit you'll reap. So I'm kind of arguing with you in this particular case. in general, you were right. I mean, in general, you never know, did a new innovation in a user interface, how much of the population does that benefit? You want it to be usually more than 12% unless you're really targeting that 12%, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Well, yeah, let's actually pursue that for a second, because in principle, we're in a situation now where we could deliver targeted capabilities in an incremental way.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I'm a huge believer in adaptive user interface.
In practice, it seems that things are organized still in terms of, you know, this is the SKU, this is what goes in the box,
yeah.
And everything is in or out, and a lot of things never go in.
I see what you're saying, yeah. No, I'm a huge fan of adaptive interfaces, and it's kind of funny because we worked very closely with the Office team as they developed the ribbon, you know, mm-hmm. the ribbon for the new Office Suite 2007,
right.
Which is they got rid of all the menus. They purposefully said they were moving away from adaptive user interfaces and moving more towards personalized user interfaces.
Yeah.
And, you know, we work with some researchers at the University of Washington that are really into adaptive user interfaces and believe that adaptive user interfaces are even more personalized, and
yeah.
We've done some research with them suggesting that they're right. But you have to be really clever about how you do it. It has to be completely obvious to the user why things have moved. It has to be completely transparent to the user what the algorithm is that makes things move.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be predictable, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the algorithms correctly and adapt the user interface pretty slowly but very, very well to the user so it makes sense,
yeah.
That's the best.
Yeah.
And then you do please everyone, right? You don't have to worry about that 12% that you got it just right for out of the box. And so that's what we want to strive for. And my group has kind of developed this motto called AI meets HCI better together. So marrying machine learning algorithms in a very usable way to interfaces is the only way we're going to get through the next 100 years, because there's just too much stuff coming at you. You can't possibly make sense of it all.
A couple of months ago, I noticed that there was a lot of interest in an incredibly stripped down word processor. I think
mm-hmm.
it was called
yeah.
Writeroom. And yeah. the idea was that at the point where you are composing text, it's really helpful to sweep away all of the clutter so that you have this quiet, reflective, uncomplicated space in which to simply focus on your words. It's actually very funny, right? Because what people did is recreated in modern GUI applications the equivalent of a 1970s green screen terminal.
Right, right.
There was actually a deep reaction to this. I mean, it really rang bells with people, and it was surprising how much interest there was in this. Following on this idea, I did some experiments with desktops and realized that it's actually possible to turn off the icons on desktops
mm-hmm.
and have a completely uncluttered display.
Cool.
Lots of experiments like this, you try them and it's just a gimmick and you go back to doing things the way you were before.
Right.
But I've noticed that this behavior has stuck. So actually I find that, you know, if I can with a single hotkey dismiss the clutter on my desktop and just focus on the one application window that I'm using, I find that I do that. I actually prefer that.
I can't remember the last time I saw my desktop.
Really?
Because I have three huge monitors and
yeah.
I keep Windows almost, they're not completely full screen, but they're almost full screen on all three of them.
That's the other strategy, is just maximizing Windows.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm not maximizing them because I want to be able to interact with them, but it's the opposite. It's getting rid of it in a different way, right?
Yes, yes.
But I hear you, that the clutter can be an issue. And it's certainly for certain people, I always hear this in the lab, I hear, oh, I'm such a visual person. I love this. So the code thumbnails idea, the data mountain idea, I'm such a visual person. I need to see it. I hear this from designers and architects.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
And I always wondered what that meant. But what it means is they don't like text. They hate text lists. They get overwhelmed by Google, you know, the search results.
Mm.
They don't like that. They want to see the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they recognize stuff better that way.
Mm-hmm.
If they actually see its contents. And so we've been, for the last, I would say, 10 years, trying to design for that half of the population that really groks visual details. Not that we won't allow you to search via text and show you, we'll show you text search results if that's what you like.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to have this alternative way of seeing all your stuff visually, we want to support that, because I don't think enough people are working in that space.
You said half the population? Do you think that's about
I
what
think
it actually
is? Yeah.
Yeah.
The last study we did was on a visualization of search results for all your stuff, So your whole, you know, your hard drive, your phone, everything. And I heard this again. I hear this all the time, this, you know, every other person saying, oh, I'm such a visual person. Hmm. And it correlated 100% with how they, I'm trying to figure out what this means, right? So I'm starting to ask questions like, how do you look at your photos? Do you look at them in thumbnail view or in detail view or right. what, you know? Right. And it correlated 100% with whether they look at their photos in Explorer in the thumbnail view.
Right. Right.
So there are some people that just like to look at things in thumbnail view, and those are the people that call themselves visual. Now I'm starting to figure this out. There's probably a lot of other ways you can describe these people, but and I've never understood those people. I always switch completely to detail view immediately if I come to a desktop that's like that. You know.
Me too.
That's the way I am. But those people that like thumbnails, they're the people that we're designing for.
You spoke about spatial memory. I wanted to ask you about temporal memory. And
yeah.
I happen to have an extraordinary example. I've been doing screencasts, which are these kind of software movies. And in particular, I've done a lot of work with other people demonstrating software to me and it being in an audio interview context like this.
Cool.
One of those screencasts that I made was with a guy called Jason Hunter, and the subject was an XQuery engine. And Jason was demonstrating to me the combination of applications that had been written in XQuery. And he was interspersing, showing me the running applications with showing me the code behind them. A couple of weeks later, I sat down to teach myself XQuery. And a really amazing thing happened, which is that I got to the place where I realized, okay, I need the function that does whatever I needed to do. And it was probably like, how do I put out this kind of HTTP header? Right? You know, so I started out doing the thing that I always start out doing when I'm learning a new programming language, which is open up a dozen different documentation windows and start sort of searching around for
right.
code samples and definitions of things. But you're trying to search for a thing, and what you need to provide the search engine is exactly the word that you lack.
Right.
right?
Right.
Right. So how do you search for the thing you don't know the name of? And then I realized that, you know, I thought back to one of the examples that Jason had showed me, and I realized, well, if he showed me that program doing that thing, then it must have incorporated the function that I'm looking for. It had to have done that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that, well, you know, right? So right after I'd seen that demonstration, he had showed me the code behind it. So I could go into the video and find it. And the most interesting thing to me was that I had a really good idea of where in the timeline of that video he had shown the application, and I was able to just kind of go right there and then go a little bit farther, and there was the code.
Yep. And how often is that supported in the user interface?
Well, never, but
rarely.
Essentially never, right? But I mean, this continued, you know, I mean, I then, for the duration of this time when I was kind of absorbing the basics of XQuery, and I went back to that video multiple times, and it was such it was such a completely different way of accessing the information, and something about the way in which I had internalized the timeline, right,
yep.
the narrative, and could sort of understand where things were on that timeline. I had a memory of, you know, when things were.
Yep.
It just, I don't know, I found it was very surprising and very interesting.
It's absolutely, absolutely undersupported. And the fact of the matter is, he probably chose a very significantly useful ordering, temporal order processing,
yeah.
for how he demonstrated that to you. So having the timeline information is even doubly relevant in that instance, because it was, you know, it's a tutoring thing that if you reprocessed it that way, that was probably optimal anyway, because
mm-hmm.
he showed it to you in that order for a reason. We totally support temporal reminding in our interfaces. So essentially, we've got tools now where you can play back your desktop and play back your phone and play back things that you use in your life, because we understand that people remember things temporally, and it's a really important cue. It's one of the five main memory cues.
Describe what you mean by playback your desktop.
So we run this logger we have called Personal Vibe Log.
Yeah.
And it captures every single desktop event, every Windows event that you carry out on your desktop or your device that's hooked up to your desktop, whatever.
Right.
And we use that for so many things in my group. The first thing we used it for was just to understand how people actually use Windows. We were the first group at Microsoft to ever tell anyone, including the Windows team, how people actually use Windows.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that was kind of important, we thought. And we looked at how people change their behaviors as screens get bigger and bigger. So that was really important. But as the logger got better and better, we've been building it for about 5 years, we realized you could use it for so many things, like this temporal order mm-hmm. order processing you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So in about 2004, We built the ability to be able to go back at any point in time and look at what you were doing on your desktop. So, for instance, if someone had shown you how to do something on your desktop, just like the scenario you were painting for me, you could go back and you could recapture that. You could relaunch those applications exactly the way they were laid out on your desktop, those exact documents. Or you could just watch it. Like, let's say we have a designer in our group, and he uses so many prototyping tools, and he says, you know, they're all like 50% the same and 50% different.
Right.
And he always forgets exactly how he did this one thing in this one tool. And
right.
If he could just go back, because he knew he was using it Thursday, and he had to figure out how to do this thing. And now if he could just go back to Thursday and replay that so he could remember how he did it, it would save him an hour.
This is huge. So can I get this thing?
Yeah.
I can?
Sure you can. Absolutely.
Really?
You're a Microsoft employee.
I'm serious.
No, we can send it to you. We've got this tool called Status Writer. It also kind of summarizes across applications and actually windows and documents how you spend your time.
Yeah.
It's a self-awareness tool more than anything else. You can kind of start to reflect about how I was seeing I was spending like 67% of my time was in email, and that really pissed me off. So, so now I look at it just to make sure I stay in email less than 50% of my day.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, so so you can use the Viblogger in so many different ways. So you'll have to kind of tell me which applications you want, but you can actually replay your desktop in Status Writer.
And when I'm replaying it, is it the kind of thing where I can kind of zoom around at ultra high speed?
We could, but right now it just literally shows you, it's a virtual depiction of your screen, and it shows you...
It's not a screen capture, it's an event-based thing, right?
It's an event-based thing.
Okay.
Right, but you can go back and we call it rehydrating tasks. You can go back and rehydrate any moment in time.
Okay.
Relaunch those things just the way you had them.
That's huge, and it actually ties into a lot of this work that I've been doing with screencasting. And
yeah,
in particular,
yeah.
I've been doing a lot of this work from the perspective of fairly highly produced demonstrations and tutorials and things like that. You know, mm-hmm. But there's another aspect to it which I've been evangelizing for a couple of years now. I don't think it's particularly caught on yet, partly because to this day, hardly anyone realizes that there's a free screen capture utility available for Windows.
Yeah, very many people don't know that.
The Windows Media Encoder? No one, to this day, no one seems to know about that.
Right, right. I get asked about that all the time.
Yeah. So the notion that, for example, I mean, if you think about how many customer support scenarios bog down at the level of, well, what did you do then?
Right? Uh-huh,
right. Right. What did you see? What did you do?
Uh-huh.
It all breaks down and as people try to deconstruct that into a textual narrative that they communicate in email or in support forums and so on. And the notion that, I mean, the truth is we're in a position now where it's actually trivial for people to say, look, I'm just going to drive through the application narrating what I'm doing and pointing to the, you know, the place where I'm having a problem, right?
Right. No, I agree with you. Because I'm a cognitive psychologist and we have cognitive scientists in my group, we really look at what are these cues to memory, because we know that from our work with info workers that context reacquisition is a seriously hard problem. People get interrupted so often.
Context what?
Reacquisition.
Reacquisition. So explain that.
Let's say you're a developer, you're working on code, and then of course, you know, every hour on the hour you get interrupted 20 times.
Okay. Recovering from interruptions, yeah.
Sorry, yeah, especially if you're more senior. The more senior you are, the more you're going to get interrupted. And so you blow away your context because you navigate somewhere, you go look at some file for somebody, you go do something for
right.
them, you're IMing, whatever you're doing,
right.
and then you have to somehow reacquire what you were doing before you got interrupted.
Right.
And we watch. This is sometimes it's a 20-minute time sink while they try to re-find the files they had open, the places they were in the code. And then even if you get all that physical stuff relayed out and get it right back the way you had it, and my group does lots of tools that supports that, you still have to cognitively remember what it was you were doing. What was the next thing, you know?
You've blown your mental stack, and that's the really tragic thing.
Exactly. And so we try to work with product teams, luckily, finally, Windows and Office at the exact same time have gotten religious about this.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in this great planning phase for the next versions of both, and they're really, really taking this seriously. And I mean, my IM message is, did anyone say demo? Because everyone is coming to the Vibe Lab and getting demos of task management tools and task reacquisition tools. So that's cool. I think some good stuff's going to happen in the next versions of everything. But Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, we're doing brain-computer interaction in my group, but we can't yet capture what you were thinking, right? I would love to replay what you were thinking before you got interrupted so you could play that back.
Right, well,
we're not there yet.
I'm ready for the implant.
Right. But, you know, we'll get there someday.
So I was curious what the upshot was. I would have loved, actually, to have been able to attend that workshop that you guys had.
Oh, if I'd known about you, I would have invited you for sure.
It sounded from the reports that I read that part of the outcome was that, you know, this is not obviously just a tools problem and a software problem, but it's also a cultural.
Yeah.
You know, we're all still very much needing to learn a lot more about how we ought to behave in these electronically mediated environments and
exactly.
how to respect other people's attention.
Exactly. I get asked that all the time, like by reporters. They say, well, you know, who are you to say that, you know, you're researching how to solve this problem when it was Microsoft's fault in the first place that we're in this state? And I'm like, whenever anybody says that, I'm like, you know, you curse us for being user-centered, but trust me, users wanted these tools. Users wanted other people to have access to them like this. This was a facilitating thing. Interruptions aren't bad. Interruptions actually help make work move forward in a positive way. You know, maybe even 75% of the time, you know, I don't think we predicted that it would have gotten this bad. I don't think we predicted that the web would have taken on like this. I don't think we predicted the way communications would be so pervasive. So now, you know, yes, we listened to our customers. We gave them what they wanted. Now we need to rethink, refocus, and retool so that, yeah, like you say, the resource of attention is respected.
Yeah.
And group process is respected.
Yeah. Yeah. So to that end, one of the things I have been thinking about a lot lately is that this is something that we ought to be teaching people from a very early age.
That came out really strongly in the workshop.
Yeah, tell me about that.
A lot of this is reteaching, not just early age, but I've been watching teenagers a lot for the last 10 years. And we know in cognitive psychology that the more you multitask, the better at it you get. So you can really train yourself to be quite good at task switching at really rapid intervals, and if that's what your job requires. And teenagers have taught themselves to do this very, very well. So, you know, the 10 a.m. windows, the phone, the music's on. And I've talked a lot with psychologists who are way smarter than I am about, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Even from my own teenager's perspective, because I always yell at my kids, you know, they're listening to music while they're doing math. And, you know, some of the psychologists really believe that they're going to be better. They're going to be more effective than we are in the workplace.
And some think the opposite.
And I think the opposite. That's me.
Yeah.
I think either they're going to like completely have to relearn how they work so they can focus. But, you know, I do look, there's something about the way they work that's much more collaborative and much more groupthink than we were raised.
Yep.
So it's more of a social cognition that's going on there. And, like, if I use my daughter as an example, she knows who is the best at topic X.
Mm-hmm.
She knows what she's best at. She gives her best stuff to her group because she knows her other friends are going to give their best stuff. And all together, it's going to be stellar in a way that none of them could have done individually, right?
Although the benefits that you've described there, which I completely agree with and support, are orthogonal to the notion that it is better for people to interrupt one another and be interrupted more and to slice their attention into ever finer units.
That depends on if the interruptions are to the benefit of the group as a whole. And that's what, when I first started doing interruptions research, people were really pissed at me inside Microsoft because I always framed the interrupts as a negative. And what I've learned over the last 10 years is they're not always a negative.
No, of course not. No, I mean, a lot of work is, the interruption is the work process,
that's right?
But
there's still a cost. No matter what,
yes,
there's going to be a cost to the individual, not
yes,
to the group as a whole. So it depends. And if you can train yourself to get better at multitasking and interrupts and reacquiring your context of your primary task, then maybe there could be an argument that this next generation maybe will be more effective. It'll be very interesting to watch it play out, in my personal opinion. I'm looking forward to the next 10 years as a researcher because I cannot wait to watch this next generation move into the workforce.
I get all the time, and I'm sure you all the time get kind of random emails from people that are basically demanding for you to tell them a bunch of stuff about something where it's clear that the person hasn't bothered to figure out if you're the appropriate person to even ask that question of.
Right. Right.
Or, you know, what level of interaction would be appropriate as a first contact and so on and so forth. I mean, there's like a bunch of basic etiquette stuff here that in some sense is age old and in another sense is refracted through a bunch of different communication modes that never used to exist before, such that
Right. There
are things that could be codified here and taught to people that I don't see it happening at all.
Well, like I said, that did come up in the workshop, and Nathan in particular is very big on, but there were several people that were very big on this educational route to making things better. And so he in particular has been tasked with Inside Intel coming up with these rules of engagement.
This is Nathan?
Nathan Zeldes.
Okay.
I hope he has put those out on the wiki, but he has like these top 10 things that he's trying to get incorporated into the culture at Intel for
mm-hmm.
how you behave in email, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
The one that's coming right to mind because it was in the Seattle PI article was don't hit the reply all, but, you know. And it's funny, naturally I never do that, but there's so many people that do. I think he has like a top 10 of those. And those are very simple things to teach. They're not exactly along the lines of what you're saying per se, but they are polite. You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? They're thoughtful. You're being respectful of other people's time.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking about it before you hit the send button.
Yeah.
None of the discussions we had were actually around the content per se. But I agree with you that because these channels are so much less formal, that I think the politeness factor is definitely lost in those channels. I would say, like, for teenagers, email is where they are forced to be polite. That's the way they look.
Yeah, that's the formal channel.
Exactly. So, which is kind of ironic to us. But, you know, I know my kids rarely use it, and they say, and this has been said for the last 10 years by teenagers, they say, oh, email's for moms and teachers, you know, moms and dads and teachers. So, you know, yeah, and SMS and text messaging only makes it worse because of the constrained input, right? So it's definitely true what you're saying, and I don't know how we address that.
Well, there's also there's the question of which mode to use to achieve
mm-hmm.
which purpose,
mm-hmm.
and the number of choices has just exploded.
Right.
In the last 10 years, we now have a whole set of issues around, well, does this go to a wiki? Does this go to a discussion
right.
forum? Does this go in email?
Well, that's why it's so hard to find your stuff now, because it's
too.
Everywhere. Your stuff is just, you know, and what I freak out about is, am I ever going to find it again if I put it in one of these more, you know, remote things, like all my sharing folders? Microsoft products have about 15 different ways you can share folders with someone. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's like, now which shared folder thing is it in? You know, I can't find it. Luckily, the desktop and the combined desktop and web search, trying to keep your found things found or stuff I've seen, any of those projects, what's resulted from that has made that much better because, you know, now I don't even have to worry about what folders things are in. I can usually get it back.
Have you personally gotten into the habit of tagging things for future reference?
Yeah, I do, and we're trying to build that into our visualizations as well, build tagging in. We worry a little bit that people won't take that extra step, but we saw that even with things like the Data Mountain, where if people took the time to co-locate things spatially, they were significantly more likely to find them later because they put that little extra effort into
exactly.
it.
Exactly. The act of doing it
exactly.
itself reinforces the memory.
It's exactly right. And so if you're the kind of person that worries about finding things again, you probably will take that extra step. We see that in task management all the time. But there are a lot of people out there, frankly, that we call them filers versus pilers.
Yes.
There are a lot of people that are pilers, and so they don't want to expend that extra energy, and then they really can't find their stuff later. So, it's that AI meets HCI better together. I think we need, for those piler people, we need really good algorithms for retrieving their stuff because, it's like 50% of the population isn't going to take the time to tag things.
Yeah.
They just won't.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, hindsight is everything. After they run through the study, they're like, oh, why didn't I do something so I could find this again, you know? But in the act, they're, you know, actually doing what they would do in the real world, which is nothing.
So what are the other kinds of prototypes that you folks have that might show up in a more mainstream way?
You touched on the fact that we do a lot of work for developers. I like to single out developers as being, they're kind of like the ideal information worker because their work is very structured
Yeah. And
because they're willing to expose their work to the rest of their team and they don't worry so much about privacy because it's to such great benefit to the rest of their team.
Yes.
Their team has to know what they're doing anyway. Normal information work is not so structured, so you can't build tools to fit that structure as easily.
At least not yet.
Not yet. And people are a lot more nervous about you exposing their task content
right.
to the rest of their team.
Right.
So we've done quite a few prototypes for developers. We're doing one right now that we had a first version. It's going to be presented at a conference in April called FastDash, which is a peripheral awareness visualization of what a software development team is doing in a code base.
Hmm.
And it's supposed to be something that they just glance up and they can see who's in what file, at what state,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in what method, who's blocked, who isn't blocked, whose file that they've checked out is in conflict with who else's file that they've also checked out,
mm-hmm.
what their status is. You know, just a real global way of getting peripheral awareness about a software development team, agile or not. Even in an agile environment where everyone's co-located, we showed that this tool is still significantly beneficial in terms of improving group awareness. And actually, we increased communications 200%. And decreased artifact use, like whiteboards and stuff like that, significantly. We thought we were going to reduce communications. We actually increased communications, but the communications were apparently described as being much more timely and appropriate.
I like that a lot, yeah.
We increased interruptions, you could say it that way, which you might look at as a bad thing, but they were so timely and relevant.
Yes.
That the team actually, the best thing was the team wouldn't let us take the display away. I like that the best. That's like the ultimate proof. So that thing, we're doing version 2, and that thing I think will actually roll out as an add-in to Team Foundation Server or Visual Studio or something.
Hmm.
We've had 6 of the Visual Studio teams ask if they can run it, and we're getting ready to go do interviews now that they've got it up and running, and we're building version 2, which I think will be much, much better because it'll be focused on work items instead of files. So we're doing a lot of stuff like that in that domain, and then we're doing a ton of stuff trying to track tasks or activities automatically. We've got some AI people in my group, and they've been really looking at the content of your documents or even just the titles of your files and how you access them in time. So a little bit of temporal information, like you keep going back and forth between these two windows, so they must be related, you know, that kind of thing. And then if you get interrupted and blow away your task context, can we, without you having to do anything, because a lot of our tools you have to manually do something, can we, without you doing anything, help you bring back that task context in a very lightweight way? That might require a little tagging, and it might not, so we'll see. So we're doing a lot of stuff like that. I have several groups underneath me now, and one of the groups is doing community technologies, so looking at how highly rated are you and, you know, what's your status in the group and that kind of stuff. We've got an InfoViz group where they're looking at really cool ways of visualizing, like, let's say, uncertainty in data. And we've got a group doing next-generation media. So what's the future of TV? So, and we've got a group doing really crazy stuff like, can you get off your desktop and use your feet to do human-computer interaction, that kind of stuff. So, and then we've got the brain-computer interaction guys. So they're all, you know, off trying to read your mind. So it's all kinds of...
In terms of the, what did you call the team awareness project?
Yeah, that's called FastDash, Fostering Awareness for Software Development Teams Dashboard.
Okay, okay. I like that a lot. It actually,
thanks.
It would be a great compliment to something I saw a couple of weeks ago. I was in England and I met with some folks from the Open University who do it.
Oh, yeah, I know some guys over there.
I was talking with Peter Scott, who was showing me Hexagon.
Oh, I've got to look that up.
So Hexagon is this system, which it turns out that only the researchers at the Open University use.
Yeah, well, that happens sometimes.
But it's this kind of, you know, everyone sees everyone else all the time kind of thing. It's pretty interesting, right? And it enables you to sort of get a sense of, well, there's Peter, and it looks like he's really heads down.
Oh, we're doing that kind of thing, too. Is it for just a regular work group?
It's for anybody, basically.
Yeah, we're doing that, too.
The connection there is that he actually gave an interesting example of how people can misconstrue what they see, lacking other context. And so the example was that one of his people had come into his office for a performance evaluation and then had gone back to his office and went and looked and saw Peter with his head buried in his hands and assumed that it was an outcome of this talk that they just had. And in fact, it had nothing to do with it, right? Because the document that he had just opened was something from his insurance company, you know, that was bad news, right? And so the notion was that, well, you know, really What you need to do is marry up this ambient video awareness with the kind of document and task awareness that you were talking
about. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
So the IM status you get is based on your desktop content.
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting.
And it's funny because when we first started it, we were just exposing everything, like exposed like who I was IMing and who I was emailing and what web page I was going to, and that was really bad. Really bad. I remember walking into my VP review and they went, and I said something like, "Dude, you know, Oscar said you rock." Yeah, I saw you were IMing him, and I was like, "Oh my god, turn that off quick." But now we raised it up to be more abstract, so you can pick what it says when you're in particular task context. So if I'm just using one application now, you can do this across applications. But if I was in IE, I might always want that to say that I'm doing research.
Right.
Or something like that, and then it's much more acceptable. And we also think it matters who you allow to see this stuff, right?
Yes.
So if I'm in a document and I have a shared folder with that document in it with you, maybe it's okay that you see I'm in that document, but nobody else can see that, that kind of thing.
The hard part there about you can pick who gets to see is that you have to pick.
Yeah, and then you have to do the programming.
Yeah, and so all of those decisions, it becomes combinatorial, and now you're back
Absolutely.
To this problem of how can we intelligently automate this, because if people have to make all these granular decisions about access control and visibility, then they're just going to be overwhelmed in a different way.
And we have tools like that at Microsoft, right? Have you seen Knowledge Network and that kind of stuff?
Not yet.
It's like 100 rules, right, of who can see this keyword about me. They mine your inbox, they mine your email, and then they pull out 100 keywords.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to say who it's okay to expose these keywords to.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone in the company can contact you because you're an expert in area X.
Right.
And, you know, going through and just saying, it's okay for this keyword for this person, but, you know, not this group. And, oh, God, it was, like, crazy. So, yeah, I think it's another case of AI meets HCI better together, because end users aren't going to go through. And it's going to be bad because the least common denominator is show everything to everybody. And I'm not sure that's appropriate.
Well, that's actually the dilemma, right, is that there are two easy decisions to make, which is show nothing and show everything.
Yep.
And then what you want is somewhere in between, and in between, it's just hard.
Well, I think leveraging the org chart, you know, some of the things Eric Horvitz does with mm-hmm. some of his user models, leverage the org chart, leverage who is in my very frequent network,
mm-hmm.
who's my boss, who are my direct reports, who's my family, who are my friends. There are some simple things you can do where you can get it pretty close, and the question is how close is good enough, right?
Right.
That's a really important question, really hard question.
Well, this was loads of fun.
Yeah, you're asking lots of very, very relevant, interesting questions. Thanks, John. It was fun.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Take care.